When is the last time you really sat down and gave yourself time to think, plan, and reflect? It's been a while, hasn't it? But you know it's important for your self-care, don't you? Whether you're new to journaling and planning and need some guidance, or you're an experienced pro looking for some new inspiration, Silk & Sonder has a solution. Silk & Sonder is a monthly journal membership service that delivers a new journal to your door every month. It's a new approach to journaling, planning, and overall self-care. With themes that change monthly, habit, mood, and sleep trackers, guided journaling prompts, and so much more, each journal is the backbone of the journal of your dreams. You will come to rely on it because you will make it your own, and it will keep you grounded, focused, and in love with yourself in this game called life. The Ties That Find is listener supported and through the Silk & Sonder affiliate program. If you make a purchase through the link on any page run by The Ties That Find, I may earn an affiliate commission. You can find my special link at bio.link/TTTF. That's bio.link/TTTF. Now let's get to the show. Gacy, Ridgway, Hansen, all pieces of shit. None of them cared enough to get their victims' names. Among them, they left 11 does in their wake. But thanks to forensic genealogy, we have been able to identify three of them in 2021. These are the doe victims of serial killers. Hello and welcome back to The Ties That Find. I am your host, Rachel. It is so good to see you or know that you're seeing, hearing, whatever. Hello again. If you are a new listener, thank you so much for checking the show out. Welcome, welcome. I hope you enjoy all the stories that you're finding here. Just wanted to shout out two awesome, really awesome reviews that I received over the last few weeks. And that came up on the Apple Podcast app. There's always a delay. So if you post something on Monday, I might not actually see it till Thursday or Friday. But in any case, I just wanted to shout them out because they're pretty awesome and I really, really, really appreciate it. First, we have from Miss Susie Q, title so satisfying. Quote, one of the worst parts of true crime for me is being so involved in a mystery and then it just ends with no justice, never going anywhere, and always frozen in your mind. The crimes on this podcast are so satisfying to hear since they're being solved with genealogy with incredible technology. Wonderful podcast. Love it. Thank you so much, Miss Susie Q. It really does, like I said, you know, make me feel awesome. And it does feel good when you finally get to the end of any kind of true crime story and there's some kind of resolution. And I think here in our little neck of the woods, it's a little extra satisfying because a lot of these were like cold cases for so long. And a lot of people had possibly even given up on them. So it's not just the resolution, but it's also the fact that essentially the police department, against all odds, was able to finally solve the case. Then we also have Pixie Being. I love that. Pixie Being says, amazingly underrated podcast. Quote, I'm hooked. Her voice is so soothing and she brings to light cases that aren't widely known. I love learning about the genealogy. It's truly mind-blowing. And that is awesome as well because I never thought I had a radio voice and I probably still don't, but I've gotten used to it. You, dear listeners, have gotten used to it. And that's what really counts. The fact that I have got something to say, people are cool listening to it, and they're learning stuff as well. So awesome. So yeah, if you are on Apple Podcasts, if you are on any other platform that allows reviews, I don't think Spotify does, and I know I have a lot of Spotify listeners, but you can also leave a review on Facebook, on my Facebook page. You can also just interact with me on the socials. You can also send me an email through the website. A lot of people do that too, just to have like a one-on-one. And let me know what you think about our episodes or maybe any case suggestions, anything, all that good stuff. In the next few weeks, I'm looking to announce our Patreon tiers. So stay tuned for that. And I guess that's it for the housekeeping. And let's talk about today's episode. So last episodes were the Sean Great episodes with his victims, both living and murdered. And I started thinking, well, you know what? We do have serial killers with does that are still out there and unidentified. But within the last year, we have had some identifications. But at the same time, I'm always thinking, well, Rachel, that's not your bag. That's not what you do. You don't highlight serial killers. You don't focus on the killer. You focus on the victim. But I do think that the notorious serial killers and the does that they left behind in their wake, when they are identified, they should be talked about and we should bring them into the conversation here on the podcast. So we have three that we're going to talk about today. One is a victim of John Wayne Gacy, one is a victim of Gary Ridgway, and then the other will be the victim of Robert Hansen. So I just want to do a brief shout out to Evelyn. Hi, Evelyn, from Instagram. Thank you so much for sending over that heads up, because it really put me in the mind frame, especially after the Sean Great episodes. I might not be highlighting, like I said, a full-on episode about a specific serial killer, but their does still need to be remembered. And that's where we are today. So we're going to do a threefer, essentially. It's going to be a bit of a whopper of an episode, because I am going to do a rundown, a brief Rachel rundown, my version of it, just to refresh us so we can make sure to differentiate one serial killer to the next. Oh, well, that makes sense. Full disclosure, I leaned on Wikipedia for the bios of all three of these pieces of shit. You get it, right? All right, let's get into it. Okay, so first we're going to talk about John Wayne Gacy and one of the final six unidentified victims left in his wake. I mean, how do we even attempt to do a synopsis of Gacy in just a few minutes? We all know him, and we all know him way too well. So I know I'm going to leave a lot of stuff out here, but we're just going to plug along on this anyway. Piece of shit Gacy was born in 1942 in Chicago, but he did not have the best childhood. His dad was a drunk and verbally and physically abusive. Gacy got out of a house as soon as he could, and he got married for the first time when he was 22. His new father-in-law bought a few Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise stores shortly after the wedding, and Gacy would be the manager of all three, settling himself and his new wife in Waterloo, Illinois. When he wasn't slinging chicken, he and his wife were hanging out in the swingers crowd, from what we hear, but he was also branching out, and he found pleasure in being with other men as well. Problem was, soon enough, these other men were actually boys. So within 4 years of getting married, and by the time he was 26, Gacy was a convicted pedophile. He was sentenced to 10 years for sodomizing a teenage boy, but only served 18 months because, well, it was the 60s and sexual assaults weren't taken very seriously, because he behaved in prison, probably a little bit of both. Once outside of prison, piece of shit Gacy went back to Chicago to be with his family. And at some point, he was officially divorced from wife number one, and in 1971, got himself hooked up with wife number two. He kept her thinking that he was a heterosexual until 1975, when he pretty much told her, hey, I'm bi, and I don't even think I'm going to have sex with you anymore, ever. He would, of course, have sex with other people, and he would be out all hours of the night, and he would bring young men, underage boys, home to hang out in their garage, and she just couldn't do anything about it. They agreed to divorce, and she finally moved out in the spring of 1976. And it was at this time that Gacy began his murder spree. The longest he would go between victims was about 4 months, but most of the time it was monthly or even two or three in 1 month. Now, this is not how all of the murders took place, but I'm just going to give you the gist of it, the general rundown of how they went. Gacy's MO was to employ young men in his construction business, and the boys would range in anywhere from the ages of 14 to 21. But these weren't like actual, like regular long-term jobs that these kids had, though. They were more like, I'll give you some work if you come by next week type of jobs, like day jobs. They might last for a few months as an employee, but they weren't like working for Gacy as a steady employee long-term. And if one of his victims weren't going to be a day worker of his, then he would just pick them up off the streets, maybe offer the job, maybe solicit them for sex, whatever it was. Either way, he would lure them back to his house. Remember, he's divorced now. He's got the house all to himself. And he would offer a night of drinking and drugs. Once there, he might suggest they pop in a porno tape. Sometimes one thing would lead to another and they'd have sex. Sometimes they wouldn't. But at some point throughout the night, maybe even the next morning, Gacy would pretend that he's going to show them a magic trick. How nice. The trick was going to be how to get out of being handcuffed. And once they were cuffed, they were doomed. Gacy favored strangulation or asphyxiation as his murder device of choice, but he did not have problems wielding a knife if it came to it. And all the while, in his public life, he is performing as a clown, which gave him the killer clown moniker when he was finally discovered. He would perform as a clown locally, free of charge, charity events, visiting hospitalized kids, etc. And he would get into the political scene, hanging around the Democratic political party clubs and get-togethers, and even getting himself elected president of his local chapter. And this was all during his killing spree from 1976 to 1978. Now, it was in December of 1978 when he did start to get sloppy, and he chose the wrong family to fuck with. After the murder of Robert Peast, who, by the way, Gacy killed on Robert's mother's birthday, knowing his mother was waiting for him to show up for her birthday dinner, we finally get to see some action from the Chicago Police Department. They had been tipped off about Gacy here and there, but victims claiming sexual assault either wouldn't show up to court, or a family complaining of a missing son just wasn't convincing enough to the police for them to go knocking on Gacy's door to answer some questions. If they did come knocking, he would just tell them, oh yeah, yeah, the kid was here, but he left. He said he was running away. He said he didn't want to be around here anymore. And then the cops would be like, okay then, thanks Mr. Gacy, have a good night. And then they'd walk back to their cars. But in Robert's case, his family was not having any of it. And finally, the police department decided to take a look at Gacy when Gacy wasn't around. As in, you know, maybe like investigate him and his activities, and maybe take these accusations that have been made about him over the years as truth, possibly. Maybe they hold some water. They end up getting a search warrant for Gacy's house. They found some suspicious stuff, like multiple driver's licenses of young men that had, what, just taken off and decided they didn't want to be in Chicago anymore. But none of this was any actual concrete evidence for them to be able to arrest him on. So they continued a shit ton of surveillance on him after that, and he knew it. He would often be able to tell that he was being tailed, and he would even stop and ask police if they wanted to come in and eat dinner with him, if he was going to a restaurant to eat. He would see them outside of his house just trying to be all stealth-like, and they really weren't, and he would come out, wave them in, and say, hey, you want to come hang out in my house? So yeah, he would even invite them into his house to chat. And this house was not the cleanest of houses. It would go from stinking of decomposing human flesh to just stinking in general. While inside the house one day, a detective actually caught a whiff of what he knew was actually a dead human body. And that's when they were able to finally search the house and under it, and the rest is history. Police would find 26 bodies in various states of decomposition in the crawl space under piece of shit John Gacy's house. Bodies piled on top of bodies, some wrapped up, some laid directly in the dirt. Three other victims were found in other places on the property, and then another four were found in the Des Plaines River at the admission of Gacy himself. All in all, he would be convicted of 33 murders and sentenced to death at the end of his trial in 1980. Gacy was put to death by lethal injection in 1994, and I can't really say that any of us are all that sad about it, right? So Gacy is the guy with the bodies under the house. He didn't have his bodies in the pig farm. He didn't have his bodies out in the woods or anywhere else on the side of the road, wherever. He had his bodies under his own house. Now, when they started digging up the bodies, imagine you're digging for coins, right? You're going to dig here in this one spot. You find a 50-cent piece. You pull it out. You dig a little deeper. So you dig even deeper than that, right in that area. You're also going to dig around the top of the earth, too, to make your original dig site a little wider in a circle. And then 50-cent pieces will be uncovered as you go. So when you find that first coin, you know it's not the first one that was put there, right? It's likely one of the more recent ones that was put there. And the older ones that were put there are actually the ones that are deeper. And they had a number of these digging sites because Gacy had actually drawn them a rough sketch of the crawl space to map out where the bodies were buried from his memory. And the whole of the crawl space covered the whole house. There were bodies under all the rooms in the house. Pick a room, there was at least one body under it in the crawl space. It's freaking crazy. 20 victims of piece of shit Gacy were identified from 1978 through 1986. That's 8 years. After that, police and their forensics teams had no other avenues to try to identify the remaining 13. Then, in 2011, science had come around and they decided to resume their efforts. More victims were identified, and by 2021, they had whittled the John Doe count down to 6, which is actually pretty awesome. One of them was body number 5, meaning he was the 5th body recovered by the police and their excavation team way back in 1978. Body number 5 was buried a whole yard under the dirt in the crawl space. So since he was buried so deep into the ground, the theory was that he was the first to be put down there. But I mean, I really wonder if this is true, because just because you're the deepest doesn't mean that you're absolutely the first. In fact, if you go by the timeline, he is the 10th victim to be buried under there. Based on the other victims, and their identifications and when they had gone missing. So when we get to body number 5 and we do figure out that he was the number 10 killed, then we know that 9 others were there already, just in different places throughout the crawl space, again, throughout the span or the landscape of the house. And maybe at that point, Gacy wanted to maybe have to dig less for each new body. So I don't know. He decided to dig a little deeper so he didn't have to make more room for, okay, right? You get it. So we'll move on. So body number 5 was believed to have been killed in late 1976 or early 1977, based on the identified victims that surrounded him and when they had gone missing. In 2019, the Cook County Sheriff's Department called up the DNA Doe Project and asked them for help in giving back the names of the 6 remaining John Does. Number 5 had a tooth still attached to his skull, and he was chosen to be the first set of remains to be investigated through the family tree. At this point, it had been 41 years since he had been taken from underneath that house, and possibly 43 years from when he had been killed. Once they got the profile into the GenMatch database, the DNA Doe Project says that they were able to find second cousin matches, which, as we know from prior episodes, is actually a really good start. If you can get that user to give you his or her grandparents' siblings' names, then you're golden, because once you get those grandparents' siblings' names, all you have to do is go 2 more generations forward. You don't have to worry about the great-great-grandparents like we've seen in other, the great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents like we've seen in other cases. Now, the DDP's page says a possible name was produced relatively quickly, but we realized that it took 2 years for them to do it. So I think this is actually because of the lab needing the time to do the DNA extraction, considering it had been 41 years since he had been taken from underneath that house. But in any case, just 3 weeks ago, the Cook County Sheriff's Department finally announced that the 5th victim of John Wayne Gacy's that was found in the crawl space under his house was Francis Wayne Alexander. So who was Francis Wayne Alexander? His family called him Wayne, and he was born in North Carolina. But by the time he was raised up, the family had moved to New York. He had gotten married before he turned 20, but the marriage was short-lived, and they had gotten divorced after just a few months. After that, Wayne decided to try out Chicago, and he headed there in early 1975. He would keep in touch with his family, though. He would call, and sometimes he would write letters and send postcards. This is the 70s, after all. And he would even do so and keep in touch directly with his little sister, who was just a young teenager when he left. The last time little sister Carolyn remembers hearing from him, she says she got a postcard a month or so before he was killed, and it said, quote, "I'll see you soon because I love you," unquote. Doesn't that kill you? Now, she was 14 at the time, and the family was living on Long Island, and she actually thought, you know what, maybe that means that he's coming home for Christmas, right? Maybe that's his way of saying that he's prepping for a visit. But unfortunately, he never showed up. Here and now in 2021, Wayne's mother is 87 years old, and according to his younger sister, Carolyn, mom remembers the last time that she got one of his monthly phone calls, which was back in November of 1976. He had asked her to send him his birth certificate because he needed it because he was looking to get a security job he was applying for out in California. Neither mom nor anyone else in the family heard from him after that. So for this reason, it's believed that he was killed in December of 76 and then buried under the house on West Summerdale Avenue. Trying to keep a positive outlook, they always just thought, well, maybe he's just living his best life without them in it. Caroline says that their mom did have an address that Wayne had given her. So, like, he had real plans. At least we know that much. He had an apartment, maybe an actual place that he was expected to live when he got out to California. And I think that's pretty impressive. So mom used this address to call the local police department out there in California. And she said, "Hey, my son's missing. I haven't heard from him. He said he was moving out by you. Maybe he's living at this address. Can you go take a look? Can you go check on him?" And the police did. But he wasn't there. But unfortunately, mom thought that this was enough to actually create a missing persons report and have police actually continue to investigate his whereabouts. But it didn't. They essentially treated him like a welfare check. "Hey, have you seen him?" They call her back and they say, "No, we haven't seen him. We don't know where he is." And then they just wash their hands of it. So from their view, they were really just doing, like I said, a welfare check on a guy that wasn't even really verified to be living in their town yet. So in this case, it really does seem that Wayne just fell through the cracks. Wayne's mom and half-brother were the relatives that submitted DNA samples for testing to confirm if body number 5 was actually Wayne. And when the Cindy Morgan matches confirmed it, the family was heartbroken, but they did finally feel some sense of closure. Brother Clyde says the evolution of DNA science and the use of genealogy is a miracle because, quote, it brought Wayne to us, unquote. A statement released by his family reads, quote, it is hard, even 45 years later, to know the fate of our beloved Wayne. He was killed at the hands of a vile and evil man. Our hearts are heavy and our sympathies go out to the other victims' families. Our only comfort is knowing this killer no longer breathes the same air as we do. Unquote. Now, Cook County Sheriff Thomas J. Dart, he says really something really insightful here, and I think it's important to talk about it. He says, quote, these unidentified young men brutally murdered by this vicious serial killer deserve dignity, and that includes knowing their names. As science evolves, it is important for us to continually apply these new tools to both new and old cases to help victims and their families, unquote. It's so fucking true. We're all over here, right? We're living our day-to-day lives. Some of us are interested in true crime. Hello, raise your hand. And we hear stories, many of us, multiple stories of the murdered and the missing daily. But just because we're done with, what, an article, a blog post, an Instagram post, or a podcast episode about a killing or killings that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago, we're going to finish reading it. We're going to finish hearing about it. And then we sit down at the dinner table and eat with our families. Maybe go do some laundry. Maybe actually get out of the car and go into work and start our workday. But some of those murder people, they're still not identified. Their families are still wondering about them all these years later. And yeah, they're sitting down for dinner. They're getting out of their cars and going to the office building. But they still don't have answers. Those victims are still not able to be truly put to rest. And I think that's why what Sheriff Dart said gets me in the feels so much, because he and his team and the team that work with the other does that we see here on the podcast and all the other ones that are out there that I haven't even heard about, you've never heard about, or the ones that you've heard about, whatever, that I haven't covered here. These detectives, they could be working on only recent cases because those are the families that are in their faces about them and they're solving them. And then they could be calling it a day and putting their feet up on the desk, but they don't. They say, no, okay, that's done. That's good. I still got to put another hour in today, and I'm going to work on this other case from 1970, whatever. These detectives, they own the responsibility of getting that dough back to the family that loved him or her, even if it had been 20, 30, 40 years, 45 years in Wayne's case. Now, I can't do that work, right? I'm not a cop. I have no authority, no jurisdiction. You can't, unless you're a cop. And if you are, thank you for your service and sacrifices. It is these law enforcement agencies, these genealogists, they have the knowledge, and they have both the knowledge in their fields and they have the pull within themselves, that internal motivation to take that time and to advocate for the unidentified victims and to work on behalf of those unknown families out there, families that they don't know now, but they want to eventually know. They're working for those families. They don't even know who they are at this point. But they're going to find out one day because they're going to bring their loved one home to them. And that is just so incredible to me. And every time I research another dope case like this, I just love. I love it. Isn't it great? Love it. For the Cook County Sheriff's Department and the remaining Gacy victims, they are still working to identify the 5 remaining does. And they have an online submission form for anyone who thinks that there might be a chance that their missing son, brother, or friend might be one of them. I will put a link in the show notes. And that is the case of John Doe number 5, victim of John Wayne Gacy. Moving on, our next serial killer and their identified Doe is going to be the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway. He was actively killing hitchhikers and sex workers from 1982 through 1998, 16 years, in Washington State, namely the Seattle and Tacoma areas. There's so much I'm not going to tell you here, so if you don't much about him, just like with Gacy, definitely check out a full-length episode on a different podcast. My first intro to the Green River Killer was an audiobook. I searched it on Amazon. I'm pretty sure it was Chasing the Devil. my 20-year quest to capture the Green River Killer. It was written by the detective that worked the case the whole time. He was one of the people on the force that really realized all these victims are victims of the same killer who ended up being piece of shit Gary Ridgway. So if you're looking to stick with the podcast format and you're down with a little humor that goes into it, check out Time Suck with Dan Cummins. He never disappoints. And he also did a deep dive about Gacy too. This is the guy whose mom washed him off after he wet the bed when he was younger. And he tells us that she washed him and she washed all of him.
Yeah.
And this was even in his like teen years, in his younger teen years. So by the time he's in his later teens, he's starting to feel, because he's used to it for his whole life and into puberty, he's starting to feel and recognize these sexual attractions to his mother, which he knew something was off about that. He knew that wasn't right, but he couldn't help it. And then that attraction turned into a morbid curiosity about what it would be like to kill her. His first murder was of a six-year-old boy when Gary was in his teens that no one knew about. We find out about that later. And he tells us it's because he wanted to see what stabbing was like as a killing method. All this is the closest that we get to understanding his urge to kill. And they're all going to be young women. And what? We're just going to kill women that look like mommy, right? How original. Gary Ridgway's next victim after the little boy came years and years later when he was just over 30 years old. He began with Wendy Cofield on July 8th, 1982, and he pretty much bolted right from the gate after that. He would pick up girls on the side of the road, prostitutes or hitchhikers. He would use them for his whatever he wanted. He would kill them, and then he would dump them in the backwooded areas along the Green River. Some victims were found within a month of being left behind. Some took years to find. Victims' ages ranged from 14 to 38 years, but there were only like a few people, there were only a few ladies in their 30s, only like three of them. He really preferred teens and young adults. This piece of shit killed at least one teenage girl or young woman, sometimes two or three or four, each month from July until December 1982. Then he took January and February off, for what we could tell. Then he began again in the spring with our Jane Doe that we're going to talk about, and then he picked up his speed again until the end of December 1983. Again, he took January 1984 off, like some kind of New Year's resolution. What the fuck? Good. It's a safe month at least in the Seattle-Tacoma area. And then he resumed in February, but then after that, he decided to taper off. So after early 1984, Ridgway's victims really came only about once a year, one every other year. They were still horrendous and still horrible, but he at least did slow down. Here's another little bit that's kind of interesting, which I didn't realize, but there it is, plain as day on the wiki. And I don't know how they know. Maybe law enforcement was just going on his word. I'm not sure. But he is believed to have killed his last victim in or around 1993. And after Ridgway married his second wife, Judith Mawson, in 1988, Ridgway only killed three victims over the course of 5 years. That's where I said earlier that his victims just taper off. Over the course of 5 years, he killed three victims from 1988 to 1993 after he married Judith. Judith would say later, quote, "I feel I have saved lives by being his wife and making him happy." I'm not sure what to do with that, so I just figured I'd put it out there. And with all of these murders, he was so skilled that he was leaving no evidence behind. Even in the early 80s, he even knew then at that point that he needed to clip his victims' fingernails if they scratched him. And get this, his depravity did not stop at his victims. Thinking about how he would pick up a girl, get her into his cab, they would do whatever they were doing, whether it's for money or he just decided that he was just going to take it, and then he ended up killing them, he did have to get rid of the body. And he was going to be dumping this, like I said, in the woods off the side of the highway along the Green River. So he would have to lug these bodies into the woods by himself. Well, if he pulled a muscle disposing of a victim, he would claim a work injury and get workers' compensation payments. You heard that right. Now, when it comes to what he's been convicted of, there's a total of 49 victims that we know of, either by name and body or by body only, aka a Jane Doe. According to records, there are another 12 victims that he has not been charged for. These are women that he has either admitted to killing, but no charges were brought for one reason or another, or bodies that police suspect him for, but he hasn't admitted to, and they don't have enough evidence to charge him for. And none of them were killed in January either, from what we know, which is so freaking weird. He was finally caught by DNA. Haha. He had given a saliva sample to Detective Reichert, the author of that book I mentioned earlier. He gave it in the 80s, but it wasn't until forensic technology got tighter that Reichert would actually risk sending it to the lab. Because remember, when you send evidence to the lab and they get the extracted DNA profile from it, that is wiped out. You can't reuse that sample. So he did wait around, and good for him on it. He had a good day interviewing Gary Ridgway. He got a saliva sample and he stuck it either in the fridge or on the shelf, whatever it was, whatever they did in the 80s that they decided was the right way to store evidence, biological evidence, and he waited. And then finally, so many years later, Ridgway's spit matched up with evidence from 4 unsolved murder cases, and he was arrested in the summer of 2003. After all is said and done, he is currently housed at Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, Washington. So the thing about Ridgway, for me at least, and there's a few things that make him stand out, but until Samuel Little came into the public eye a few years ago, Ridgway was the most deadly serial killer in the United States, according to convictions and or closed cases that are attributed to him. That is, until Samuel Little came into the picture in 2014, and ended up being named the most prolific serial killer with most kills in the United States, topping out at 63 confirmed and 93 confessed. So why isn't Ridgway as well known in the public eye as, say, Gacy or Bundy? That's what I don't get. Or at least until I start thinking about it. I think it's because he was not handsome. He actually looks like a sewer rat. And he never flew off the handle to the people in his life. Everyone in his life was completely shocked when they found out about him and what he had been doing. And unfortunately, his victims were less dead than rich white girls. They were runaway girls who were far from home or living on the streets, or they were sex workers. They were victims, and even by his own admission and every other admitted serial killer that goes this route when they find their victims, pick people that are not going to be missed. But with these bodies of Ridgway's, these women, they definitely would get found, and police would come to suspect that a serial killer was leaving these dead women behind. But other than their location and the cause of death, there was nothing exceptional about Ridgway and his deeds. He was married. He had the same full-time job for decades. Little to no run-ins with the law. There's nothing sexy about him as a serial killer, like as far as his MO goes. But come on, his victims are just as dead as Gacy's victims, just as dead as Bundy's victims, just as dead as Dahmer's victims, and they deserve to be remembered too. Not all of Ridgway's victims were identified as soon as they were found, just like with Gacy's and just like with every other prolific serial killer out there. Once you got too many bodies, it's going to be really hard to know that you've got every single one identified. In fact, Detective Reichert tells us, quote, "The sad part is there were so many unidentified names that you had to put numbers to the bodies instead of names. It sounds very dehumanizing, but it was the only way that we could keep track," unquote. Okay, so Ridgway's youngest victim was named Bones 10, 1984. No one knew that she was out there, somehow concealed, I guess, for over a year before she and one of his other victims, Cheryl Wims, was found. They were found by, I believe it was a maintenance worker who worked nearby, because he had actually dumped their bodies by a little league or like a baseball field. So an employee at the field came across their bones at some point. Once arrested for the suspicion of those 4 other murders and the interrogations began, one of Ridgway's first confessions was to Jane Doe's murder and to Cheryl's, and he told police where he had left them. At this point, police had known about the bodies and they added them to his kill list. He thought that she was like in her 20s or maybe late teens, but Bones 10 would be estimated by the coroner or the medical examiner to be between the ages of 12 and 18 years old, white, and about 120 pounds. She was believed to have been strangled to death. There were no bullet holes in her corpse or in her clothing, and Ridgway admitted the same. But Bones 10, discovered March 1984, wouldn't be identified until earlier this year in 2021, even though it was in August of 2019 that the DNA Doe Project was approached by the Kings County Sheriff's Office to help identify her. By early September, Kevin Lord with the DNA Doe Project, he actually took a big part in helping to identify Lavender Doe, one of our early cases. He had her DNA profile in the GEDmatch database back in September of 2019. But it wasn't getting anywhere with the Cindy Morgan matches that were coming back. Eventually, he decided to also try the Family Tree DNA database. They are like Ancestry. You can pay to have your DNA done, get your profile, build your family tree for your own purposes. But they do also have like the side database that law enforcement is allowed to check. Now, it's very hard, and I'm just going to bring it up here. I'm not sure where Family Tree DNA stands right now when it comes to allowing law enforcement into their database. Their privacy policy on their website says no, just like Ancestry, you need a court order. But I did read somewhere recently that they were used in order to identify someone, whether it was a perpetrator or a Doe, I'm not sure, but someone as recently as within the last few months. So I'm not positive. Maybe they do have an opt-in part of their website, because I'm not on Family Tree myself. Just so if you're interested in doing this and opting in or putting yourself out there, or if you're not, but you're hooked up with Family Tree, just read over their privacy policy and you know, you want to make an educated decision for yourself. Anyway, so Kevin Lord decides to jump into the Family Tree DNA database, of course, legally, and he actually does find a better match than the ones that he found in GEDmatch, and he creates a Family Tree. But it took him a whole year from uploading to GEDmatch for the first try to finally coming up with a possible name over at Family Tree DNA. So it went from like September of 2019 when he first had a profile to put in the system. And then finally he was able to get a name back last year, about September, fall-ish 2020. Kings County Sheriff's Department contacted the family, asked for DNA from one of the parents, her possible parents. And then they announced on January 25th of this year, 2021, that Bones 10 was in fact Wendy Stevens, a runaway from Colorado. Yeah, it's pretty far away. A lot of times we hear about a Jane or John Doe and we ask, well, was she ever or he ever reported missing? Hello, family. Where were you? How come you weren't looking for her? And here's your answer. They were 1,000 miles away. They did know she was missing. In fact, she was 14 years old. 14, dear listener, can you believe that? Her family had known that she was missing. They had worried about her. They had wondered about her. And they had searched for her for 37 years. Once she turned 18, though, the police dropped her name from the missing child database. She had essentially aged out of the system. So now Wendy's name, age, physical description, last known location, identifying characteristics, all that stuff that goes into missing persons databases, she had been erased by 1984. And so when police departments around the country start talking to each other across like the internet, when the 90s came into play, 2000s, 2010s, she's not there. So how could Colorado police and Wendy's parents, how were they to know that she'd somehow made it all the way up the Pacific coast to Seattle? She'd gone missing in 1983, and then she was killed in the spring of that year. That means that she'd been away from home for, what, most 3-4 months, maybe? She was taken from the world that fast as soon as she left. Well, we can ask, how did Wendy get up there? Did she travel by herself the whole time? Did she have a friend with her? Maybe it was a guy. Maybe it was just another friend, a girl. And then whatever, they just went their separate ways when they got north. Because for me, if she did have a friend with her from Colorado and they were still in contact and she went missing from that friend, surely they would have called back home to tell her family that she'd vanished, right? Maybe they would have even called the local police from where they were up in Washington. But then if that friend was also just as young as Wendy was, maybe not. Maybe they didn't want to be found out either and brought back home to Colorado if they were a runaway too. We may never know. It's just so sad. For the Stevens family's part, we do know that they were searching all these years. And by 2019, they had even heard of GEDmatch, Yes, because they were searching for her and they were searching for ways to find her and find out what happened to her. They found a site that could help you find long lost relatives. Awesome. So one of them, I'm not sure if it was either mom or dad, we're not sure, but one of them took a DNA test from either Ancestry, 23andMe, some other company. And once they got their profile report, they did upload it into GEDmatch, right into GEDmatch. Awesome. And that was in 2019. So now you're asking, Rachel, then what the fuck took so long? How come Kevin didn't see them on the match list? Well, I'm here to tell you, because in September of 2019, when Kevin got in that system, September comes after May, right? GEDmatch had opted everyone out by the time Kevin got Wendy's profile into the system, and Wendy's parents didn't get the memo about opting back in. Now, GEDmatch has since changed their policy again. I know, but this is for good. At least we want it. At least we hope it is. Sometime this last summer, and I can't remember when it happened, but I saw it on. either the GEDmatch Facebook page or the DNA Duo Project Facebook page. They did reopen their full database to law enforcement, but it was strictly for identifying Jane and John Doe's. I guess they said, you know what, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it to identify the Doe's. So GEDmatch is now reopened recently, but at the time it was closed off. And that's why Kevin didn't see Wendy's parent in there and why it ended up taking a year to find her parents in the end. So for those of us in the same position that Wendy's parents were in, clearly you're not in the same position now because you're educated after almost 40 episodes. But for people that are in your life that may not know about this, and somehow if it gets brought up in conversation, please just make sure that they are aware if this is something that they want to be opted in for. They're already opted in on GEDmatch for Jane and John Doe purposes, but they do need to opt in for any of the prosecution purposes. Wendy's family has been quiet since finding out about what happened to their daughter. They have requested the media respect their privacy, and we do not have a tribute for them, which of course is completely fine. We hope for nothing but the best for them in their healing. But we do have something from the volunteer at the DDP. On being part of the team that identified Wendy, Carrie Ann Binder, a forensic genealogist volunteer, tells us, quote, "I think a lot of people listen to true crime podcasts or they watch documentaries and things like that, but we actually get to help solve these cases and it's a really exciting thing to do it," unquote. And I couldn't agree more. Love you, volunteers over at the DDP. It must be such a wonderful feeling. There are still two unidentified Jane Does that were killed by Piece of Shit Ridgeway. The DNA Doe Project is working on them, and we hope for resolutions to their cases soon, just like for the Gacy victims. These are Jane Doe Bone 17, found in early January 1986, and there's also Jane Doe Bones 20, found in August 2003. I believe she was discovered with the help of Ridgeway himself. After he began confessing, police would interview him for months to get the confessions and have him give as many details as possible about each victim, when, where, how, etc. And he actually did make attempts to help police find and identify his victims. Of course, it was on the promise that he wouldn't get the death penalty, but at least we get some closure for some of these families in return. The DA did agree, and he was sentenced to life in prison, which I'm fine with, because that actually helped a whole lot of families get the answers that they needed and some closure. And that is the case of Bones 10, 1984, a victim of Gary Ridgeway. And finally, we come to Robert Hansen, also known as the Butcher Baker. Piece of Shit Hansen was born in 1939 in Iowa, and he's known as the Butcher Baker because his father had owned a bakery growing up, and Robert decided to continue the family tradition when he became an adult. But then he also created his own tradition by becoming a serial killer, hence the name Butcher Baker. He, like Gacy, did not have the best relationship with his dad, and he, like Ridgeway, had distorted views about the female sex. His particular problem was a stutter that he developed at an early age and the fact that puberty was not so good to his skin. These things made him pretty vulnerable to an insane amount of bullying in school, which came from both the boys and girls, which did not help his love life and later on his sex life. Now, it's widely held that Hansen's future crimes are pretty much a retaliation for the rejection that he received from his dad and the kids at school. No friends, and then particularly the girls at school. But he ended up having two marriages, so I don't know. Hansen was born in Iowa, like I said, went to school, graduated, had a first wife, spent some time in jail for burning down a school bus garage depot, all before he was 22 years old. During his short stint in prison, his wife divorced him, and his psych evaluation dubbed him as a manic depressive. But today, we prefer the term bipolar. Even so, when he got out, he found himself another wife, and then they moved all the way up to Anchorage, Alaska. So I really don't think it's that bad if you can get two women to marry you by the time you're 24, right? Whatever. He was still unsatisfied. So then the year is 1967 when they move all the way up to Alaska and they set up a bakery shop just like you'd wanted. And you think this would be a wonderful second chance at life, right? You have some jail time in your past. You've got a shady past. You want to get over it. Now you've moved to this beautiful area. You have a beautiful, wonderful wife. You're soon to have a couple awesome kids. You set up a bakery, and you own your own bakery, which is exactly what you wanted. You like to go hunting, so you get to go hunting on the weekends in the beautiful Alaskan wilderness. What could be better? Well, for Robert Hansen, he also wanted to rape and kill, and he knew that the law wouldn't allow for that. So he waited a bit before diving in, and his first known sexual assaults would be in 1971, 4 years after they moved to Alaska. He was accused on two separate occasions in 1971 of kidnapping and rape or attempted rape, but only served minimal time based on his good references because, you know, he was the town baker. I guess if we have to put it into context, as this was the early 70s. People weren't taking sexual assault seriously back then, and people were more prone to go with their one-on-one impressions of a person than to entertain the idea that that person might actually be a piece of shit when he was behind closed doors. So I wonder, do you think we are like that still today? Not accepting of sexual assault, of course, no. But I mean, say you're told by a coworker that another work friend was arrested for a series of bank robberies. Do you think that you would be more likely to question your evaluation of that friend here and now in the 21st century and maybe testify on his behalf to a judge than you would have been if you were living in 1975? I guess so, because we have learned a lot about psychology and how people can lead double lives since we've delved more into the human mind and how it works and public lives versus private lives over the past decades. And in fact, it's almost weird if you don't have some kind of hidden secret nowadays that no one knows about. I guess, I mean, I like to think I live a pretty authentic life, but you might be surprised to learn some of the things in my past, and I'm sure I'd be surprised to learn about yours. But all this is to say, just because you have a friend, a boss, or even a pastor tell a judge that you're a nice guy, doesn't mean the judge should give that as much weight as the testimony and physical evidence presented by the victim. Hansen's murderous run lasted about a decade, if you go by the police record, which I'm going to, and we'll see in a second. And he was finally arrested under suspicion of 4 murders when Anchorage Police Department got an FBI profiler to look into those 4 murdered women and come up with a killer profile that eventually pointed them in Hansen's direction. After a lengthy interrogation, he finally gave up a lot of his victims, 17 in total, that he would admit to, but he wouldn't admit to all of the victims that police thought were his kills. So if you side with the police, his first kill was in 1971, and then he would go into 1983. But if you go by the murders he admitted to, he started in 1980 and then went to 1983. There is something to say about serial killers that confess their crimes, give details, lead police to bodies, which is what he did for a handful of his victims, like we saw for Ridgway and also Gacy. And that does create trust and credibility. So maybe the women that he denied killing really weren't his victims after all. But not so fast, because when they executed their search warrant of his house, police found a secret map behind his headboard of locations in the area surrounding Anchorage. And more than half of them had X's marking the spots of known body sites. Other X's were locations where he denied dumping bodies, but where, in actuality, police did know bodies had been dumped. So, what's his explanation for that? In this rundown, I don't have an explanation for you. Sorry, I do not know if he offered one. Take a deep dive somewhere else. Once again, time suck. Might as well. Hansen's MO was to seek out, wait for it, prostitutes and exotic dancers. Because, wait for it, he knew they would be less dead, less missed. Shocker. He would abduct them and bring them back to his bakery to rape them or to his house. God, can you imagine, though, this man had survivors. How do you look at a donut the same way again? And I'm not trying to be funny. I'm serious. The trauma is on so many levels. Sometimes his wife was away and he would take them back to his house. Once finished, he would pack them up in his car, drive them out to the airport hangar where he kept his plane. Yes, he had a small plane and a license for small aircraft. And then he'd fly them out to the woods where he would release them and play the most dangerous game with them. Except Piece of Shit Hansen always won. These women were killed either by gunshot or an up-close and personal stabbing, which is a special kind of torture in and of itself. To be given the opportunity to run away, knowing that that's what your killer wants, knowing that he is a recreational game hunter. But he wasn't always in it for the hunt and the kill, though, ironically. He was also discovered to have abducted the women, brought them back to his lair, whichever it was, raped them, and then, if they were convincing enough, he would actually let them go. Upwards of 30 rape victims endured this type of attack, and then when he set them free, they didn't report him. Or maybe, if they did, they weren't believed. Because who is a judge going to believe? A sex worker with no close family or friends? Or a local businessman who always delivers on your standing Monday morning donut order for the office? You decide. Hansen would admit to 17 murders, 12 of which whose bodies were found only because he helped police find them. Thank God for small favors. He revealed their identities and their locations as part of his plea agreement, where the prosecutor agreed to only charge him for four of them. Those victims were Sherry Morrow, Joanna Messina, Aklutna Annie, and Paula Golding. Aklutna Annie is suspected of being as one of his first victims, and she has yet to be identified. In the end, Piece of Shit Hansen got to live a long life, even after his incarceration, all the way up to 75 years old. He actually spent 31 years in prison, which is more than we can say for a lot of serial killers out there. We are told that he died of natural causes. He was 75 after all. He had had some health issues developed by then, and what with the food and the minimal health care that they get, it's not really a surprise that he passed. If anything, it's a surprise that he lasted that long. So don't worry, we're not feeling sorry for him in any way. And this finally brings us to Horseshoe Harriet, first found in April of 1984 with the help of Piece of Shit Hansen. He had estimated that she was killed sometime around January of 1983, and she was killed and left in the woods near Horseshoe Lake, a few miles northwest of Anchorage. All Hansen could or would offer about her was that she was a sex worker, and he had abducted her from Anchorage. Okay, well, we've figured that much at least. The medical examiner wasn't able to come up with much more either. They estimated her age to be around 17 to 23 years old and that she was white. And that's pretty much all law enforcement had to go on for all this time. They did put what info they had about her in the missing persons databases, but seeing as how it was the 80s, we're really not surprised that they couldn't get anywhere. And the search for her identity eventually went cold. Horseshoe Harriet was buried as an unidentified doe in a cemetery in Anchorage. Decades passed, and of course, police still had their file for her in their caseload. And it was in 2014 that they reviewed it yet again, and then talked amongst themselves and got permission to exhume her body. The lab was able to create a basic DNA profile, not the kind that we need for the family map, more remedial one, and then they uploaded that into the FBI's missing persons database, hoping for a hit. But they got crickets. Finally, in September of 2020, the Alaska Bureau of Investigation's Cold Case Unit reached out to a different lab and asked for another kind of profile, the kind that can get you the mitochondrial DNA information, the one that can be put into familial DNA databases. That's the one we want. And so after all this time, 37 years, police were finally going to get somewhere. Once they had a good profile, they called it Parabon, who accepted the case. They soon were able to make up a family tree and gave police a name. Police reached out to the family members that they believed were the closest to the unidentified doe. And on October 22nd, 2021, ABI's Cold Case Investigation Unit announced that Horseshoe Harriet had been identified as 19-year-old Robin Pelkey. So who was Robin Pelkey? Unfortunately, we really don't know. We actually have even less information about her than what we had about Wendy Stevens and her road to being identified. She had been born and raised in Colorado, which actually is kind of weird because so was Wendy. But somehow, in some way, Robin also made it way up north. She made it way further north, though, and she ended up in Anchorage. She had been killed when she was about 19 years old, based on her date of birth given by her family. And that's really all we have about her. Her family, just like Wendy Stevens, has requested their privacy, and of course we want to give them that. There is one final victim that is attributed to Robert Hansen, and her name is Aclunta Annie. She is believed to be his first victim, but he never admitted to killing her. Public Safety Commissioner James Cockrell said of finally solving the case of Horseshoe Harriet, quote, "I would like to thank all of the troopers, investigators, and analysts that have diligently worked on this case for the last 37 years. Without their hard work and tenacity, the identity of Miss Pelkey may never have been known." How true it is. And that is the case of Horseshoe Harriet, one of the victims of Robert Hansen. And there you have it. We also have a few other does that are identified that are believed to have been killed by serial killers, identified just this year. Also in 2019, a possible victim of Henry Lee Lucas was Orange Socks. She was identified as Deborah Jackson. Then we have a doe victim of Samuel Little that was identified just this last September. Her name was Clara Birdlong, I believe. So let's ask ourselves, what other unidentified does are out there that are victims of serial killers? Here's just a quick short list. Clark Perry Baldwin, he is not officially declared guilty at this time. He is pending trial, but he is suspected of killing Bitter Creek Betty and Sheridan County Jane Doe back in the 90s. There's also Wilson Schuest. We also talked about him here on the podcast. He's actually served time for killing Ventura County Jane Doe, and she has not been identified, and it's believed it's because she has South American heritage and her family is just not represented in the database. There's also Mission Jane Doe, a victim of Robert Picton, the pig farmer from up in Canada. And then we have three Jane Does that are still attributed to Andre Chikatilo, who is, it's over in Russia, but, you know, maybe Europe will come around. I know, I believe Australia's coming around, right? All right. Well, I think that's going to be it for today, and I will see you in 2 weeks. Until then, find me on the socials. All right. Bye.